We will begin with Jim reading a staff summary.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Backman and committee members, this is staff measure summary on House Bill 2484. It expands the Oregon pre-kindergarten program to include additional children, directs that full funding be made available for the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, appropriates money from the general fund to the Department of Education for expansion of Oregon pre-kindergarten program.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2484, and Representative Nelson, it's nice to see you, and we presume that you are ready.
Thank you very much, Chair Backman, and members of the House Committee on Education. I appreciate very much this time to be with you today, and I appreciate your open-mindedness, resourcefulness, your creativity, and your desire to help the kids in our great state of Oregon. Chair Backman and members of the House Committee on Education, on behalf of the children of the state of Oregon, their parents, and all citizens, I thank you for this opportunity to appear before your committee. It's with deep concern and great hope that I'm here today to seek your concurrence and collaborative support in searching for a way in which we can eliminate what I feel is an unwarranted form of discrimination. That of providing an early education for only a portion of our youngest disadvantaged children and not meeting the critical need for an early head start for all children, a serious step in their positive development and their future. Today we are fortunate to have several individuals here who are far more competent than I am to explain this need. However, as a parent of 8 assorted children and a grandmother, and as a former teacher, I've longed to see that our little children get the chance of a lifetime to mature to the greatest extent with their God-given abilities into their greatest potential. I cannot forget the case of one foster daughter, Debbie, who was lost forever by the time she came to live in our home as a teenager. With minimal parental concern and existence in a less than adequate home environment, I worry today where she is. She lacked self-confidence, purpose, and the basic skills other children develop early if provided a venue in which to develop, both positively, physically, and mentally. Because of her circumstances, ones that she did not select for herself, she was easily influenced by the negative forces of drugs and dropouts, and ultimately ended up on the streets of Hollywood. While we attempted to change her mind and her life, she had been conditioned from her earliest days to exist without the basic skills that could have given her a positive future. For all children in like situations, this is basic reason I ask you to help me in seeking all ways in which we can begin at once to cure the situation we have here in our state. Lack of early educational intervention that can ultimately change a child's life from one of futility to utility, from negative to positive, from ineptness to adeptness, and from disadvantage to advantage. Before we continue with other testimony by these fine individuals who are here today, I humbly request that we do not consider House Bill 2484 as the fully implementable tool for providing for all of our smallest citizens, but a starting point for collaborative effort among agencies, schools, Head Start programs, child care centers, volunteers, professionals, and parents in evaluating our programs and financial sources to prevent leaving any child behind. We hope to find a way to be an inclusive educational community for all children who need us and need us early in their lives in order to accomplish the mastery of their abilities in the assimilation and use of the basics, knowledge, self-discipline, and self-confidence, and the adequate development of skills that will secure for them a good, sound educational environment in which they will develop to their fullest potential. I want to thank our teachers and our institutions, as well as the private groups who have dedicated themselves to our children for ages 3 to 5. I have yet to find an individual who does not believe that providing an early start in education with a concern for the whole little person is a fundamental implement for staying power and positive development in later schooling and life. There are numerous studies which we want to provide the committee as we continue to map the way to be an inclusive early educational state for all children. There are also several amendments to our House bill which we will ask you to consider in the future. As I close, I want to briefly highlight validated facts that have come from various sources, and you will receive these reports in their entirety. Not to scare you, but I do want to express my appreciation for all who have submitted data for us so that we could bring you a total picture. For validated facts, I want to begin today by telling you that we will be procuring for you this publication if you do not already have it. I would imagine that Superintendent Hobson already has this book. It's called Inequality at the Starting Game: Social Background Differences in Achievement as Children Begin School. And this is a most recent study. And for those who may not know, this will fully back the facts that we're going to be discussing today. I want to also point out that we are just one among many, many states working on this very issue today. And I just want to point out that with one single vote, the legislature's budget committee of Wisconsin, managed to meet the increasing child care needs of children and participants in their Head Start program, averted a $95 million shortfall in that area, and narrowed the gap in their state budget considerably. Only reason I want to mention that is it shows us that where there's a will, there can be an A. When we talk about state developments in early child care and early education, I would just like to speak to the Children's Defense Fund, a report of April 2002. 46% of kindergarten teachers report that half of their class or more have specific problems when entering kindergarten, including difficulty following directions, lack of academic skills, and or difficulty working independently. Research has consistently demonstrated that participation in high-quality pre-kindergarten programs can be critical to later school success. Children in these programs develop better language skills and have higher likelihood of future school success. In kindergarten, teachers rated children who had participated in the program of pre-kindergarten significantly better than their peers in language, literacy, logic, math, even music, movement, creativity, social relations, and initiative. In fourth grade, 24% more program students passed the reading test, and 16% more passed the specialized math test than non-program classmates. And importantly, one-third fewer program students had to repeat a grade than non-program students, saving the state $11 million annually. Every child should have access to higher quality early learning opportunities that meet their needs, whether in Head Start, child care, or other pre-kindergarten programs. Programs should also be available on a full day, full year basis to meet the needs of working families as well. Across the country, there is growing support for investment in these type programs. I have for you various research statistics, and I'll be happy to provide those to your committee administrator. As most of you know, the federal government asked a panel of child development experts in 1964, almost 40 years ago, to draw up a program to help communities meet the need of disadvantaged preschool children. 40 years have almost come and gone, and we have yet to do this. It's amazing to me that as we look at the various leaders in our history, we have individuals from the former senior President Bush to Theodore Roosevelt to numerous political leaders who have fully endorsed the value of Head Start. Yet, we have continued to leave children behind. Knowing that most usually one has to ASK to GET, that's what I'm doing here today. I ask you to leave no child behind. Will you help the children, their families, and our communities? To take the rhetoric out of what is reality, whether it be the use of public television, much like the $10 million we funded for OPB in the last session, libraries, communities, churches, businesses, colleges, medical professionals, volunteers, schools, partnerships, programs with tax incentives, our trusts with the right ingredients, we must take our first steps now. The children already have. Continuing to crawl will result in the continual fall of the true equality for all. In closing, I'd like to say, let's lead. Leadership is the rarest talent on earth. How better to secure that education is the great equalizer of society by being the first state to find a way to bring up a child in the best way he or she can grow and go. Readers are leaders. Funding in an uncertain economy calls for certain changes in our attitudes and actions, in the way we do business, especially when someone's lives depend on us. And what is possible? Sustenance of eagerness to learn while the mind is most receptive, strengthening of families and ancillary units brought together to help build positive futures, less crime, less dropouts, less mental illness, less drug use, and yes, even less suicide, by building healthy bodies with healthy minds and healthy self-images now. What if we had done this 40 years ago? And ending the plague now of our state being known as number one in hunger and number one in unemployment by becoming the number one child caring state. Is this not the very best economic development for Oregon? Where else will we ever get such a huge rate of return on the investment of our citizens and our taxpayers? I was fortunate. I got a head start. My brothers didn't, and Debbie didn't. I don't want any more regrets. Let's not have any more. Will you help me? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Thank you very much, Representative, for your testimony. If it's okay, we'll call up three at a time because we do have three spots, I think. So it looks like Annie Soto, Mandy Markham, and Karen Whitman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing the Oregon Head Start Association. And today I'd like to introduce Annie Soto, who is the president of that of the Oregon Head Start Association and also director of the Wayne County Head Start program. And at the request of, of Representative Nelson, we've brought you a variety of different individuals, staff, and parents who will talk about briefly their experiences with Head Start and the value of that program. And so, Annie, I'll turn it over to you, and you can introduce the rest of the members.
Thank you. Chair Backlund, members of the committee, thank you for your time. For the record, my name is Annie Soto, and I'm the executive director of Head Start in Wayne County, where we currently serve about 800 children and their families and have over 500 children on the waiting list in Eugene and Springfield alone. I've been working with Head Start since 1978, and I'm dedicated to the program, not because I work there, but because I've had the opportunity to see the changes that have been made, not just in children's lives, but also in the families' lives, with dynamics that can change the entire family, no matter how many children are in the family and being served by Head Start. Certainly the state faces dire economic challenges, and so to look at a program that serves children from 3 to 5, a preschool program, I'd like to first focus on some of the economic benefits and then refer to some of the research, which we have quite a bit of. Currently in Wayne County, I will say to you that across the state, be it in Pendleton or Harney County, Coos Bay, Portland, or Eugene, you all have excellent Head Start programs, many considered cutting edge from the national perspective. We have the federal state funding interface where the state dollars are leveraged and used well with the federal funders in terms of providing excellent early childhood services. When we talk about early childhood services, we're certainly talking about education and literacy services. We're also talking, and I will just run through some of the things that Head Start children are able to learn and focus on. Children learn how to be social. They learn how to be appropriate in a group setting, how to be ready to learn in kindergarten. They learn if they don't know or practice brushing their teeth, washing their hands, squeezing into their elbows, and it's important to study. And many other skills. They learn to speak for themselves, and they learn to listen to the teacher and the other adults in the room. The parents learn to advocate for their children. And often, especially if a child has a special need, there is no other advocate for a child as they are trying to be, as they try to enter into public school as little individuals. Currently in Lane County, we have just leveraged some funds with the health department, and children are receiving fluoride varnishes, which will prevent dental caries and help in terms of insurance in the future. many of our children, actually over 150, are children with disabilities. Another 120, some of them the same children, are seeing mental health professionals that because of family dynamics or stresses or trauma that they might have received before coming to Head Start, they have a need to for some help. One of the children, one of the little boys in Springfield, basically was considered an offender by his mental health counselor that would not be appropriate for public schools. After 6 months of class and a lot of dedication and work on the part of Head Start, the mental health community, and the health community, including the child's physician, this child is quote-unquote seen as typical, and the single dad who is the caregiver has received enough counseling and help that he can feel that he can keep the child, not send the child on foster care, and have this child be successful. We work with the Department of Human Services in terms of leveraging their funds for 160 children to receive full-day care while their parents are working. We work with Goodwill, St. Vincent de Paul, Catholic Charities. I could name you a number of local but also statewide services whom we collaborate with. And again, share funding, leverage funding, use funding to make sure that the families are getting their needs met in the most economic and appropriate way. When children, if they are in the program 1 year or 2 years, enter kindergarten, we hope, we truly believe, and if it wasn't a class day, we'd have a kindergarten teacher here to tell you, those children are ready to learn, and they have excitement. Typically, there's a lot of research, and I'm going to tell you just a few things that we could document, but just really make a big difference. We see families, we encourage it, that families read to their children 3 to 5 times a week. For my past, that was certainly something I remember every nap time and evening time as my mother would put me to bed. Children are learning to appreciate books, but their parents are also understanding their role as a teacher of their child and their responsibility to help their child be the best that they can be. Our teachers typically have associate degrees. They're not 4-year degree people, and this is something that has been increased over the last 4 years. The family advocates or social service workers help those children and families find medical homes, that they have dental providers, that the immunizations are up to date, and when there are medical problems that they are followed up on. In Lane County, Harney County, Portland, actually in 6 different programs, we have a software where we've been able to aggregate the data from those programs, again, a cross-section of the state, in terms of looking at what are the outcomes of Head Start in terms of the educational gains. And we've submitted that report, Galileo report, to you. And basically, what you can see, and they're lovely graphs, colorful graphs, but basically the point is that children, through individualized learning, with the input and the participation of parents as partners, move individually from being ready to learn a skill and moving on to higher skills, be that learning letters and numbers, be that learning physical skills that will actually help them increase their intellect in the future. We are able to track those things, and we are able to proudly say that this is the improvement the children have made. Many people would ask, I'll answer it before you ask, don't children of that age just learn on their own? Certainly, children move toward maturation. I just want to say that the children in our program, over 40% of those kids make less than, of those families have an income of less than $10,000 a year, and love their children deeply. But those kids would not have an opportunity for an early education without Head Start. And the parents understand and learn to understand the value of the education and work with the staff. So the staff, the community, the parents, and the children work hard to gain skills. I could probably go on much longer, but I understand that you have 2 bills that you'll be hearing, and so I thank you for your time. And I hope that you refer to the 2 packets of research that we left. One was a number of studies that was recognized at the National Head Start hearing on the Hill, January 29th. And the other packet has to do with the Galileo report, which I referred to, which tracks the children's progress. And I would like to introduce two of our Head Start parents. And Mandy Markham is, and her family are, I'm going to say from Nanhill County. I don't know particularly Mandy.
Yes, I'm Mandy Markham, and I'm a Nanhill County Head Start parent. Currently, I am the past chair of my policy council. I sit on the state and regional boards as a parent representative. So I not only represent my own story, but those that I hear around the state and the region and the nation as well. I wanted to come today when I spoke with Mr. Metter and Representative Nelson's aide. He said we could use all the research we could get. And you can find stats and you can find statistics, but I don't think that you can measure what we as parents learn. I don't know that there's any way for you to do that. So I thought of some ways that maybe I could show you in a parent's life that Head Start works. And I wanted to start with my beautiful daughter here. This is Mercedes, and she was my first Head Start child. She's now 9 years old. She went through Head Start for 1 year. When she went into the Head Start program, she was referred by ESD. She had a severe speech impediment. She couldn't be understood. At the point that we entered Head Start, I was ready to give my daughter up for adoption because every time I would tell her not to do something, she would do it. I thought that this child hated me. Head Start came into our lives, and through early intervention and screening that Head Start did, we found out that this child had a cognitive disorder, and the doctors diagnosed it as something along the lines of dyslexia of the brain. So when we would tell her no, that meant she would go and do it. I also would like to add that I came from a very dysfunctional family. When my parents divorced about 10 years ago, the judge said that it was the most dysfunctional family that he had ever seen that did not have drugs, alcohol, or sex-related crimes. I didn't know how to be a parent to this poor child, and I was struggling, and I was ready to give her up. Today, she is this beautiful little 9-year-old that you see the picture of. She has been honored for things that she learned in Head Start. One of the things that she tells people that she learned in Head Start was how to eat right, and she now will take an apple over chocolate. And people think that she's weird because she'll have the vegetables instead of the pizza. And I brought with me a little packet of some of the things that she has done, little pictures of her in the classroom doing activities, her first drawings and writings, her first using letters, learning how to write. That's a pretty exciting day. And it was even more exciting when, after 3 months of the program, I was able to understand what my daughter said. And not only that, my parents were able to understand her on the phone. And my dad got off the phone and he says, I could understand her. What is she doing? And I said, well, Dad, she's in Head Start. You know, she's getting speech therapy. They're coming to the classroom. They're helping her. They're coming to the home. They're doing visits. Boy, I'm learning how to be a parent. Today, like I said, she's that beautiful little 9-year-old girl. In kindergarten, she starred as Little Red Riding Hood, who memorized all of her lines and was one of two children in her kindergarten class to leave reading. Last year, she was honored for her love of books in her little brownie troop. She learned that love from Head Start. Last year, she also got to write down some things about her. She's turning 9 on Friday, actually. And she wrote how old she was, and what she wanted was 10,000 books. This child loves to read. She has read all about the Indian Wars and George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. She loves science. She has scored in the highest levels of math and reading. And some of the research, my personal research that I brought with me, was not only her little packet of her accomplishments here. I'm going to lose a child. But I also wanted to give you a little feel for who she is. The teachers can't believe that she has all these disabilities, and I thought if they want research, what I need to show you is how she's doing in school now, after Head Start. This is last year's report card. The teacher wrote, Mercedes is a very bright and caring young lady. She has passed all 24 sight word tests. Now, that was before December. She was done with everything that was required of her for that year to learn. She is currently working to pass 3 and 4. Mercedes enjoys art and often chooses to draw during free choice. Mercedes continues to be a self-directed learner. Her handwriting is beautiful. She loves writing stories and illustrating them. Her spelling has improved this trimester. Mercedes is currently working to pass 3 and 8, 6 and 4. The third report was Mercedes is ready for third grade. She has grown so much this year. Mercedes is a self-directed learner who has improved academically in all areas. Keep reading and writing those wonderful stories through the summer. My next Head Start child was Royce. Out of 100 children, we were told after testing that he would be the very last one to be understood. And whether that was from all the illnesses that he had as a child or whether his sister's problems came into play, I don't really know. But I know that I could not understand this child. After 2 years in the Head Start program, he went into kindergarten after learning all sorts of wonderful things. And I wanted you to hear what his kindergarten teacher had to say when he entered kindergarten. Royce is a welcome addition to our class. He has made a good transition into kindergarten. Working on letters, sounds, and identification will further benefit Royce's progress. The second trimester, Royce is making good progress. I'm sure he will continue to improve as things get better for him. One thing I did neglect to tell you that during all this, my little son was a victim of crime. And if it weren't for Head Start, I don't know where our family would be right now. The third trimester, she wrote, I've enjoyed watching Royce's progress this year. When he entered kindergarten, he knew it was 14, I believe, is how many I counted, of the uppercase letters for the alphabet and 8 of the lowercase. By the end of the kindergarten year, he knew all but capital N. My third little guy, oh, I didn't show you any of his beautiful work either. He is very talented. Oops. Oh, I don't know what I did with it now.
While you're looking, I might interrupt. Committee, I see that that Mandy has portfolios handy. So we know that portfolios are a collection of data, so I just thought I'd throw that out there for the benefit of the committee.
You guys are sure welcome to look at them. Royce has several awards. This was some of his first writing here when he was trying to start writing his name. This was his Head Start stuff on 10-3 2 years ago. His first little man that he drew. That was pretty exciting for me. Today he has beautiful handwriting. Before he went into kindergarten, he was adding sums to 10, to my surprise. His first little math test, perfect score. That doesn't happen often, I don't think. Maybe it does, I don't know. But I am just so proud of him. But I did bring some of his beautiful artwork. Some of them are torn and tattered, his Indian. Things that have adorned our walls and whatnot. My third child is Che, and he is in the Head Start program now. Che has a seizure disorder, and he suffers from stomach reflux. And a lot of times he's not a happy little camper because he's in pain. But I did want to show you some of his work as well. He is learning to write his name. He would much rather cook than do art. And this is some of his art that I took off the wall. Now, you may not think it's too much, but, you know, for him, wow. This is when he first went in. He's trying to write his name. You can see how he has a little C here with little squigglies around it. This is an E here. He likes to do summer reading programs with the other kids where you read for the summer. This is just made this last week. He made a little card, and you can see again he's working on his letters of the alphabet. He has his C. He has his H. It's upside down, but you know, when you're a kid. His E. And over here, I thought he was drawing little birds, and he says, Mom, look, it's the M for Markham. So he is a wonderful child. And I am just here to tell you that Head Start works. This is his name tag that he made on his own. Without Head Start, I don't know where our family would be. I know that we would not be together. As a parent, I've gotten a lot of education from Head Start, and I don't want to leave that out, but I know that I'm running short of time. I brought all sorts of little pictures from the classroom, if you want to look at them, to see what they do in the classroom. But I also wanted you to see what I've been able to do as a parent. I have a stack full here of certificates between my husband and I for all sorts of things. I've been participating in the Child Development Associates program. I have several certificates that I've obtained through Head Start here. One's for volunteering. I not only volunteer in Head Start, I'm a smart reader at my children's school. I volunteer as the volunteer room parent in one of their classes, survival swimming. I would have never stepped foot out of my door before Head Start. And this year, and this is a personal thing for me, I was named as the Parent of the Year for the state, our region, and I was second runner-up at the national level. And why this is so personal for me is because I didn't know how to be a parent. I was swinging my children on the swing one day, and I saw a friend that was having this great time with their kids pretending. And I thought, oh my gosh, am I supposed to do this? I don't know how. Head Start taught me how to do that. They taught me how to feed my kids nutritiously. They taught me the things that I didn't know how to do. And you may ask, this is her third year in Head Start. Is this program working? I can tell you that it is. I'm now a full-time student in college. I'm working on a pre-law degree. My husband is also part-time in college. And I hope that we will be able to help other parents in their circumstances. I know numerous parents that are improving because Head Start doesn't let you stay stagnant. They come into your home. They set goals with you. They teach you about nutrition. They give you education. They feed you at meetings. They make you knowledgeable about issues. And I cannot tell you how this program has saved my life and my family. So as we move forward, I would hope that each of you would remember our story and that in some way I've made it personal to you by bringing my children to you. Because for me, nobody can measure Head Start on research. Nobody can measure where I would have been without those sweet teachers that came in and role modeled for me what I didn't know, and how thankful I am for a program that doesn't just work for kids, it works for families. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce Karen Wickland from Portland Public Schools Head Start.
Chair Backman, I'm not only a parent, but I'm also Parent Policy Council Chairperson. That's the equivalent of PTA.
We had a tragedy in one of our schools, as you know. Someone burned our classrooms up. So I'm a little emotional. I want to apologize. Okay, apologize. I brought pictures also. I didn't almost come today because of that. These are my children. I have 24 years of experience with Head Start. My oldest is 28 and my youngest is 3. I also have grandchildren going into the program. My oldest is almost 28, and she's going to go to Portland State University. She's doing an environmental science degree and hopefully going to environmental law. This is my daughter Miranda, who was recognized in Head Start with learning disorders. She's got an IQ of 73, but in college. My babies and my granddaughter. This is Debbie's handwriting. She can write her name. My son, who wasn't ready for kindergarten, they said he probably wouldn't even be ready by the time he was 6 with learning disabilities that were recognized at Head Start, and he's now a student at Tubman and getting B's. We never thought that he even learned to read. And then I've got my grandson, he'll be going. My daughter Alexis is going to be a vet tech, and as soon as she finishes high school this year, she'll be in college. These are all Head Start students from the Portland area, except my oldest in San Diego. I'm so proud of all of them. They've just really, really progressed. And, you know, Head Start has also helped me become someone that speaks up and advocates for my children, because before I wouldn't even go to a PTA meeting. I didn't feel like I belonged there. I didn't feel like they cared what I had to say. I'm policy council chairperson, so I'm really involved in every aspect of our program.
I run our PTA meetings, our parent policy council meetings. I was here 2 weeks ago talking to some of your fellow legislators about Head Start funding. Our program does so much more than just educate our children, teaching them to read and write, teaching them to become students. They teach parents to go out into the community and be hands-on parents. Be sure that people that don't have parents even support our programs. We have ESL programs, English as a Second Language. We have counseling. We do height, weight, and vision screenings in the school. We provide nutrition services not only at our school but at home for parents that are interested in bettering their home lives. We have things. We have a head lice fund. I know that sounds really weird, but we even have a program where if a child has head lice, we go into the home and we help rid this family of head lice so that that child can remain in school. We recently revised our ideas about the NIT problem. I know this, you know, it sounds really odd, but I just want you to know how thorough we are with the things we do. In fact, that was one of the things we were going to do yesterday at our policy council meeting, but our executive committee. But because of the fire, we were unable to hold that meeting. Our parents from other schools are going to the Kelly site tonight at 6:30 for support. We're a family. The whole group of schools, we have 9 facilities. I've talked to different parents from different facilities, and we're all going to try and add support. We're going to do grief counseling. You know, our children's pets were killed. My daughter was upset because she thought her school burnt. Oh, my snowflakes. And then she said, when she found out it wasn't her school, she said, oh, those poor children. Mommy, did their snowflakes burn? You know, and actually it was Valentine's, I found out, and I talked to one of our parents from that school, and she was crying, and her little girl was crying about her Valentine's. So I think the family that Head Start is in each community is so vitally important to have that support. Not only for that, but we have programs where we have energy assistance that comes out of our fundraising. We have got, I'm trying to start up, one of the other programs has a Friends of Head Start, which is a program for people like you that maybe don't have children but are friends of, that can, lend your opinions, or maybe, you know, be in fundraising, or talk to your friends in you know, the other House reps and the senators, the legislators, that can really help us with the funding that we really need, not only with this, but with lots and lots of other educational issues. She tells me I'm running out of time here, so I really want to thank you for listening to me. I don't mean to be so emotional, but it's been a rough week. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Yvonne Roberts and Eva Pignotti and Wendy Gutierrez. I pronounced those correctly. Oh, I did. Well, good.
All right. Great. You could leave them and then we'd look at them.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Backlund and the Education Committee. My name is Yvonne Roberts. For the record, I work with Head Start of Yamhill County in McMinnville, Oregon. I'm here to tell you about Head Start in two perspectives. I was a past parent back in 1991. I was a parent of Head Start. I actually went the first day with my child because I knew very little about Head Start, and I didn't want to send him to a program that I knew very little about. So I rode the bus, went with him, found out they needed a food service person in the classroom. I applied, and voila, I had a job with Head Start. So I went the second day as a staff person, and that was 12 years ago. I keep telling my boss, you're not getting rid of me. I'm not going to let you get rid of me. I want to tell you why I believe in Head Start. Like I said, I started out as a parent in the program, and I came back as a staff person the next day. I truly believe that Head Start has, you know, we talk about how Head Start helps the child, and it truly has. My son is now a 10th grader in high school in McMinnville. He has a college-level reading skill, which I says, I right here is a testament to Head Start, because I myself did not introduce him to books when he was that young. I didn't know I had to. Head Start did, and he, his words, quote-unquote, Head Start put the books in front of me and gave me the want to read. He is now in the middle of reading The Art of War, something I've never even touched, if that says anything. He's an excellent student, gets good grades. But not only does Head Start help the child, it helps the family. 12 years ago, I know you're not going to believe this, but I didn't vote. I honestly didn't vote. I wasn't paying taxes. I was on welfare. I am now voting. I love to vote, I have to tell you. I feel it is my privilege to get out there and vote. So I am now a voting, tax-paying citizen because of Head Start. I also sit on, because of Head Start, I was voted from my friend's organization. You heard Karen speak about a friend's organization. I also am from a friend's organization of Head Start of Yamhill County. And that friend's organization sent me to the State Association of Head Start. I am now sitting on the board of directors for the State Association. I sit on the board of directors for the Regional Head Start Association, which encompasses Idaho, Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. I also sit on the National Board of Directors for Head Start, which encompasses all 50 states. So, you know, I started out as a food service person. Head Start gave me some classes, sent me to some Chemeketa classes, I should say. I am now in the fiscal and HR part of our program. I am a very blessed person to be with Head Start, very humbled. Head Start is my life. I will continue to plead the case of Head Start for as long as I can. I know funding is not available now, but when it does, and I'm not saying if, I'm saying when it does become available, please think of the children. We are truly serving the nation's poorest children, and they are our future. Please think of them when that funding does come available. I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them for you.
Thank you.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, my name is Eva Pignotti, speaking today in favor of House Bill 2484. I'm the operations manager at Community Action Head Start of Marion and Polk Counties, which serves 587 children and families. My work revolves around program planning and the processes of recruiting, selecting, enrolling, and transporting children. My observations today are about changes in our economy and changes in Head Start. There is some irony in the fact that as our economy has floundered, making more families eligible for Head Start services, so has our budget been reduced, thereby reducing the number of families we can serve. Recent state budget cuts will result in corresponding federal cuts unless another source of matching funds can be found. In our program, this will result in the reduction of 100 children's slots. Over the past 3 years, I've noticed that we do less recruiting, and yet we receive more applications. Our waiting list has increased in size by 35% since the 99-2000 school year. Our client base is growing larger. Deciding who will be enrolled and who will go on a waiting list is kind of a triage, requiring judgment about who among the needy is the most needy. No one gets into the program anymore just because they're low income. That's not enough. You have to be more disadvantaged than that. This kind of hierarchy of the needy has created a different climate in the Head Start classroom. Most of the children in our program have special needs of some sort. If they weren't referred to us from special education, there's been abuse in their family. If their parent doesn't have a disability, they were prenatally exposed to drugs or alcohol. The Head Start teacher's job has never been harder or the classroom more challenging. When a child enters our program, they aren't just coming to preschool. Trained professionals test each child's vision and hearing and ensure that a physical and dental exam take place. They may assist the family in finding health insurance or a doctor or dentist who will accept their family. Developmental and behavioral screenings are conducted, helping in the early identification of delays or special needs. Families are served in their native language, and home visitors assist parents in locating necessary resources, such as food banks, energy assistance, or GED completion programs. Children are served two well-balanced meals each day, and they learn to set the table and develop good table manners. Our goal is to help children become socially competent and kindergarten ready. Just as we have to make hard choices about which classrooms we may close and which staff we may lay off, you also have hard choices about funding programs and helping Oregon's most vulnerable citizens. We think these children are vulnerable and worthy of your investment. Head Start is only available to a child when they are 3 or 4, the best age for developing healthy habits and a love of school. If we don't invest in that child, the opportunity is lost. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Gutierrez. I am currently the Education and Environments Manager for Community Action Head Start with Marion and Polk County. I've been working for Head Start since 1991. I've worked in 3 different states with 3 different programs. I know I don't look that old. I've been a teacher's assistant, a floater, a bus rider, office assistant, teacher, head teacher, family advocate, and I'm privileged to be working with on the administrative level now. I help to coordinate the curriculum and work with teacher training. It's been exciting for me this past year to see how Head Start works the last 2 years since I've been in this position. I have 2 points to make. Head Start works for children, and that Head Start also works for staff. First, about the children, you've seen a lot of portfolio evidence, and Annie talked about some of the statewide studies that have been done. On our local program level, we've really seen the way that children are growing in our local program. As Eva said, we have 587 children that we're looking at. They're growing socially and emotionally. They're learning to understand their feelings, to be adjusted, to be able to separate from their parents, how to care for a classroom, follow classroom routines, rules, understand the needs of others, sharing, all those important social skills you need when you enter kindergarten. They're also growing physically in the area of gross motor with their large muscles. They're learning how to run and jump and hop and gallop and walk on balance beams, ride tricycles with control, kick balls, throw accurately, all those things that the nationwide they're telling us are declining among children. They're also learning to control their small muscles in their hands, draw shapes, letters, and words, and have better eye-hand coordination in our local program. We've also seen them growing in observation skills, staying on task, cause and effect, sorting, measuring, understanding positions in space, counting to 10, all those pre-math skills, as well as learning to role play and many things that are helpful in those pre-reading skills that help them there. They're growing a lot cognitively. They're also growing linguistically. We see children in our program making progress in English. Children that came in not speaking English, now they're able to have conversations, extended conversations, where they can go back four times with an adult. They're asking complex questions, able to follow two-step directions, answering questions, all those things in the English language. That'll benefit them a lot when they go to kindergarten. Children in our program are seeking out books. They're learning how words are written down. They're learning about letters, how print has meaning, how to retell stories, and using letters to write words. And we're keeping statistics on that, and we're really excited to see the way that our children are making progress. My second point is that Head Start works for staff, and I wanted to talk about who our staff are. Nationwide, 1/3 of our staff are former parents, and I looked it up in our computer this morning. 26% of our staff in Marion and Polk County were parents in the program. They often make much less in Head Start than they could make elsewhere. Many are first-generation college students. More and more of our staff are looking like our children. We're trying to hire staff that speak Spanish or come from a Hispanic background. Many of them are both working full-time and going to school, trying to better themselves. Hopefully, I'm hoping that many of them will become elementary teachers or maybe legislators someday. I would really like to see them. My goal is not to keep them all in our program, but to see them better the community. It's very exciting for me when I see a new teacher's assistant come in with their GED or high school diploma, decide that they really want to be a teacher someday, work on that, work toward that goal, and see the way that they gain that capacity in themselves to move forward. And I really value their commitment to grow as educators and their commitment to our program as well. I really don't think we pay them enough for what they do every day between wiping noses and wiping up spills and teaching children social skills. So my point is just if you could continue to fund Head Start, it makes the world a better place for children and our staff members. We know that they're going to go on to be very productive members of society. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bring a tour of our program. If any of you would like to come and visit here in Salem, since we're so local, you're welcome to come and visit or read to children or see what we do.
Okay, thank you. Michael Eichmann?
Yes, sir. You're going to have me up here alone, huh?
Is anyone else signed up?
No. Oh, Anita?
Okay. Anita, you can certainly come up too. That would be great.
Yes, you are. Good company, I feel. Good company. Well, Chair Buckland and distinguished representatives of the committee, it's nice to be here today, and thank you for taking the time to listen to the story of the families and the people that we serve. I think people have been telling you about how Head Start works and why it works, and it clearly works for children, and it clearly works for their parents. A number of those staff people, it's been a life-changing event, I think, for a number of people who work in the program. I didn't have children in the program, but it's made a significant difference in my life just being a staff member for a program like this. And I started working in 1978 for Head Start. I have a degree in early childhood, but my degree is in elementary education. I have a bachelor's, and I've been working for three different Head Start programs over the course of the 20-some years. So I think that one of the things that I see happening for Head Start, it's really about the quality of relationships that people bring to their work, and that we've developed a culture, I think, as an organization based upon some very strong principles or performance standards that are nationwide that really build significant relationships, comprehensive relationships with families. And I think you've heard a number of parents talk about the degree to which those relationships have changed their lives. We've become a jobs program in some ways. I mean, Head Start has provided so many people with employment opportunities for meaningful work, to do significant, I think, work with young children and to make a difference. I know of having taught elementary school, and I look at what happens in the nature of our relationship with education and the money that you have to fund. If you were to just take a quick, you know, and I'm going to do a thumbnail sketch, but probably 95% of our capacity for learning as human beings gets developed in the first 5 or 6 years of our life, and probably 95% of the dollars that we spend on education happens after that period of time. And so right now we're spending a very small fraction of money for the education of our children, and I think these children that we're talking about dealing with right now, we're only serving maybe less than 10% of the children nationally and in our state that are eligible for these services. And those kids are probably the neediest kids in the state. The economics of serving them over the period of their lives, there's tremendously more remediation costs that would be involved in serving these kids later if they didn't have some of these services early on. So I think these dollars are some of the most important dollars that you could invest in the education of children and looking at where we go for the future. I guess the other thing I would say is that beyond what happens for the kids, I think you've heard parents say what's meaningful, important to them, and how this program has changed their lives. I think we're teaching people about democracy. Two of the people who sat up here today were involved in a governance process of their organizations. They were elected by a very similar representative democracy process that they will elect representatives at classroom level that then come to a program level, and then those people are elected to both state, regional, and national levels, and people talked about that. And they're learning the elements of how our democracy works and how the political system works, and they're learning how to engage that process and how to make a difference in their own lives. And I think what we do is so comprehensive in nature, and even the performance standards don't really talk to all of the elements of how a good program, a well-run program, does its jobs. I think the thing that you can feel comfortable about in knowing about the Oregon program is it's probably one of the most dynamic programs in the country. We have directors that are very engaged in a very cooperative process. Our folks at the Department of Education have worked with the Region 10 Head Start people and have a very dynamic relationship and coordinate the services that we get so that there's a seamless relationship between the state-run program and the federal program, the federal Head Start, and that's unusual in the nation. We really provide a model of something that's very unique and that is, as I said, one of the highest caliber programs in the country. I know we're already serving less than 50% of the eligible kids in our county, and that this is a program that we serve the neediest of the needy and the lowest of the low income. Those kids are less than 50%. At this point, we use the OMB, the poverty guidelines, and the folks that are living on even less than half of the income guidelines are the people that we predominantly serve. And so these folks are not people who could pay for this service or who could somehow get it somewhere else. And if these children didn't have this program, they would be really without. And I think I'm here to speak in behalf of the bill, but in truth, I know that this bill can't pass right now based upon the political realities and the economics of our state. What's really important to me at this point is I think that we can't take any more cuts from this program. We need to maintain the funding levels where they're at and be able to hold on to what we have, because we can't rebuild the infrastructure for how it is. The folks who sat up here and talked about a program, the classroom was burned down recently. Well, when we get out in the hallway here shortly, we're going to be talking about how other Head Starts come together and pull together building equipment and supplies, and how it is that we can get those classroom materials back and get them so that they can have the materials, because the state doesn't have money to even provide that at this point. Neither do the feds. That the money just isn't there, and we're going to do what we can to get, kind of cannibalize other parts of programs around the state to bring the equipment together to see that those classrooms get set up. But if you erode the funding at this point in time in these programs, a lot of that infrastructure will be gone, and it'll take years, a decade, to rebuild it if we lose ground at this point. So the thing that would be most important is not to erode the quality and the degree to which we have funding for the program right now. That's what my appeal to you is, in an honest sense about what you can do and what we can do at this time. I think we need to hold our ground and then look towards how it is that in better times we can truly grow the program to meet the needs of the whole number of children who would be eligible. If you have questions, I'd be more than willing to answer it. I've provided an article over here. It's called How Head Start Works, written by another Head Start director, and I facilitate a group of directors. We meet about quarterly, and I'd be more than willing to take questions if you have them from your areas as well. Back to them. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, Michael, when you're talking about no cuts, you're referencing the 2001-2003 biennium?
Yes.
Yeah. And, of course, the governor's proposed budget has reduced that, I see, by $4.4 million.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we would really, like I say, we're losing already at this point. We've taken a bigger cut than any other program within the Department of Education, and we understand that we need to take some, and we've dealt with that, and I know in our own program, we've eliminated a week of service. We've doubled the amount of weeks at spring vacation. I myself am taking 3 unpaid weeks. Every administrative person in our program is taking 3 weeks off between now and the end of June. We've laid off a teacher and put kids into other classrooms, and we've saved $55,000 in our program. And we know that everybody has to take some hit at this point, but we can't take more at this point, and it will really interrupt the integrity of what we have, and that's what I appeal to you, is to not make any other cuts.
Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your honesty and your realism in this, and I laud you for the fact that you're taking this opportunity to hit us up alongside the head regarding the next biennium.
Anita.
Good afternoon, Chair Backlund and members of the committee. It's very nice to be here with this friendly group again. And I was asked to come specifically to address the fiscal issue related to House Bill 2484. First, I would like to really commend our representative, Donna Nelson, for the good work that she's done in thinking through the need that our state has to fund all of the children in a preschool kind of program. Her passion and her plea for us to do that really touched my heart, because I feel the very same way. is that we have numerous children who would certainly benefit from the concept of the services that Head Start provides. And then, so we definitely support the concept of this bill from the Department of Education in terms of full funding for all children. And I'm also jerked back to the concept of reality in relationship to what Oregon Pre-Kindergarten was originally intended for, and that the purpose of the program was to serve first all of the neediest children, the lowest income children were identified as those children that would be eligible to receive the state funds for program services in the comprehensive Head Start program. So I've given you two concepts. The first concept is the fiscal consideration, and underneath that it says first guesstimate. And in doing this fiscal workup, we made some major assumptions about the bill. First of all, we assumed that the bill meant to fund all 3- and 4-year-old children, that it was a bill intended to serve all children in Oregon who were eligible for a pre-kindergarten program. And then we made an assumption that the bill also meant that Oregon Head Start, or as it's defined by the Head Start Performance Standards, is the program that would be implemented. We also assumed that we would want to maintain the state-federal partnership because there's maximum opportunity for us by doing that. And so this guesstimate is based on the current costs that we have for Head Start. You can see that if we were to fund all of the 3- and 4-year-old children with a COLA added, a 3.5% COLA added, and we eliminated took out the federal funds, that the cost of this could be as much as $1,367,196,882. Now, that's a very scary figure, and I want you to know there's a lot more work that could go into looking at how we would analyze doing this. This is just the first rough look at what the picture might be if we just did it, the program as we currently do, and if we funded as we currently do, and if all families received the same services as we currently do. So there's definitely room for dialogue about other ways to look at serving the neediest first, and then what kinds of tuning could we do to add on services for those families who maybe didn't need the total comprehensiveness of our current Head Start program. At the bottom of this page, you can see what the cost. Oh, I should also mention, when I say the $1,317,000,000, that's the total amount. That is inclusive of the $53 million that we currently have targeted for Head Start. So, if we pull that out, it would be like $1,264,000,000. So if we take out the $54 million, it doesn't seem like much of a savings, but I want to point out that that's the total cost, and it is inclusive of the $53 million in the governor's budget. If you look at the bottom of the page, you can see just what it would cost if we simply funded all of the eligible 4-year-olds, all of the children who are 4 in the state, and we said we were going to offer preschool services for that population. It would be $700.5 million. So you can see that there's quite a cost to being inclusive as we currently know the model. The other thing that I did for you on the second page that you received, it just says fiscal considerations, and Representative Nelson asked me to do this quite quickly when I saw her at about 12:30, and she said, oh, I want to know what it would cost if we just did Head Start. So again, I'm saying to you, this is our initial blush at looking at these figures. If we just funded the children who are currently categorized as being eligible based on poverty, the poverty dynamic, then the cost for us, the total cost, if we're estimating that Oregon pays approximately 40% of the funding that comes into the state that serves Head Start, that would be Oregon's share, and that's approximately where we are currently. Our cost, the total cost would be $139,570,774. Now, again, that is inclusive of the $53.5 million that is currently in the governor's budget. So it would actually be new money that we would need to fund all four-year-olds based on Head Start eligibility criteria, the poverty criteria, we would need an additional $85,988,000, so about $86 million, to fund all four-year-olds in the program. I would be very happy to answer any questions. We'd be happy to do more work on this if requested, and be happy to look at this in multiple kinds of ways with our Head Start partners.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Well, I can briefly editorialize. I certainly appreciate all of you who have come and testified and truly spoken from your heart, as well as the experiences that you've encountered over your years with Head Start. I appreciate Representative Nelson bringing this bill. I wish we could realistically promise that we could really fund these programs at the level that you've requested. All I can say is that if we don't do that, at least we're hearing an issue that I think is very important. The importance of early education, I think, is obviously very significant. So I think this has been an excellent presentation, and I'm really pleased that we could hear it. Representative Hobson, did you have...
I would just agree with you. I can't imagine there's anything that any of you said that we didn't agree with. That's kind of the double bind in which we find ourselves, because I think you're absolutely right. People who talked about the importance of the early to save money at the other end, there's just no argument, and I'm looking forward to reading the information you presented. But I also, as I said before to Mike, I appreciate the realism that we'll work very hard to keep what you have.
Thank you.
And hope for better days when we can give you more of what you need.
We sure appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Farr.
Thank you. I grew up in the English schooling system, and in England you begin school when you're 3 years old, and very early kids who have special learning needs are pulled out, and they receive the special learning and training in separate classrooms. I was quite shocked when I came to this country, and that wasn't happening universally. As with the chair and the other vice chair, I listen to every word, and I love your pictures. My goodness, hopefully we can help in some small way.
Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2484, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2575. Public hearing on House Bill 2575, and so Jim, you have a staff summary ready for us.
I do, Chair. Chair and committee members, this is House Bill 2575. It allows the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to set the time period for issuance of initial teaching, personal service, and administrative licenses, modifies the requirements for issuance of continuing teaching, personal services, and administrative licenses, declares an emergency, and takes an effect on passage.
Okay. With that, then, would Vicki Chamberlain come forward?
Good afternoon, Chair Backlund, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. We asked for this legislation to help us iron out some wrinkles in implementing the new license, and I need to apologize to you that my testimony isn't in writing. I probably capture it later, because after my hearing this morning in front of the Budget Committee, it became clear to me I needed to take an totally other tact in how I approached helping educate you about this bill and help us. So what I'd like to do is, do you have the materials in front of you?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think I'd like to do a little history of the new licensure system. That licensure system arose out of the ed reform movement. And a lot of people think it all started in 1991 with House Bill 3565, or Oregon's Educational Act, but it really started in the 80s when they started piecing together pieces of reform and sort of culminated in a big package in 1991. Part of the discussion in the 1980s, and this, I know I'm aware that some of you want me to talk about the master's degree. I'm going to do it in pieces before we get to the big part. Was to totally redesign the teacher education programs in the public universities of Oregon. And so I graduated in 1980 from what was then Oregon College of Education, which is now Western Oregon University. And at that time, every teacher graduated with a bachelor's degree, and you had a major in your subject matter area. And then if you wanted to continue on and be a secondary teacher, you got a master's degree or equivalent, like a fifth year of education, if you wanted to continue to teach in at the secondary level. That was the old licensure system. Well, part of the Reform Act, they thought, wouldn't it be better if I majored for 4 years, didn't have any education classes, and then when I came out, after I had my major, I would get my master's degree by exclusively doing education. So that arose our Masters of Education and Teaching programs. And in Oregon today, coming out of a public university and some of our privates, 75% of our Oregon graduates come out with a master's degree under this design. So I would then get my math degree first with possibly no mind at all toward teaching, and then go in and get my master's degree and acquire my education experience, practicum, student teaching, and classes. So now we are to 1991. When we passed the Oregon's Educational Act for the 21st century, we expected more things from students. And I think you are struggling with that. I heard Chair Backlund mention the Certificate of Initial Mastery. I think the expectation of the bill would be that we would know when I graduated from high school what I could do, not merely which classes I had had and which credits I'd taken. Well, the question then arose, do we have our teaching workforce that can lead students to those outcomes? And there was a lot of concern that our old model perhaps wasn't there. So the work began on the new model. The legislation was proposed to you in 1997 to start in January of 1999. And the legislation that was proposed totally grandfathered all the existing teachers that were already licensed to keep their license exactly the way it is today and continue it as long as they were teaching, and would apply to all new graduates after January 1, 1999. So that means that 99% of our workforce is not part of this licensure system, just to give you a little bit of scope right now of the impact of that. Since 1991, TSPC has issued just slightly over 6,500 initial licenses, and I'm going to talk about these new initial licenses. That's our brand new first stage license. Of those 6,500 initial licenses, just over 2,950 of them are employed in the public schools. So that leaves about 3,550 teachers who have the license who aren't working, and I tell you that to get to some of the details of the problems we're having with this bill. So if we have 2,900 or so working initially licensed teachers, we have 32,000 employees in the public schools, so it's slightly less than 1%, and that's how I got to my 99%, just so you know how I did the math. So we're here today to ask you to help us iron out the wrinkles. So I want to talk about what the new licensure system looks like. And if you want to know anything about the old licensure system, I'll do my best to answer those questions. I'm going to start with the goldenrod. Okay. Basically, today, if you are a new teacher in Oregon, you will get new teacher, and I just want to refresh your memories from the last time I was here. Teacher for us means administrator, school nurse, school psychologist, school counselor, and teachers. So when I say teacher, I also mean administrators. So the initial license applies to all of those folks as well. If you come in here from out of state, the only license you can get in Oregon is a transitional teaching license. And if you have completed a teacher education program in another state, then you can get an unrestricted transitional license, which means that basically I can get my transitional license and make applications to any school districts. Later on, if you want me to talk about a restricted license, we can go there, but that's a whole other discussion. So what I tried to do here is map out for you, if you're from out of state and you have been through a teacher education program, this is the license you'd get. You'd have to have your bachelor's degree or higher. You have to show proof you completed the program. Every teacher in Oregon has to have a first aid card. Every teacher in Oregon has to show knowledge of the civil rights laws. Every teacher has to be fingerprinted. And it's not renewable. It's only good for 3 years. So if you want to continue teaching in the state, you have to meet the requirements for the initial license. This is not dissimilar to many other states, just so that you know, but we'll come back to some of the problems we have with this model. So let's assume that I am a totally informed and headed forward out-of-state teacher, and I can complete all my requirements. My next option in Oregon would only be the initial teaching license. That's today, under today's design. So what that would mean then, by the end of the 3 years that I'm on the transitional license, I will have had to have passed a subject matter test. If I'm an elementary teacher, it's different than if I'm a secondary teacher. I will have had to pass a basic skills test, and that's pretty much really the rite of passage into the next licensure. I mean, you have all the other requirements for this license if you come from out of state. Now, you are not required necessarily to teach all 3 years on that transitional license, so if somebody came in and got the transitional license and wanted to take the test right away, they could get the initial license as soon as they passed the test. For your information, without going into too much detail, what's attached here are the standards that the teacher preparation programs have to show that Oregon graduates have acquired in order to come out and get an initial license. And I think this is a good time also to give you one other little detail. We license about 6,500 new teachers a year. That includes in-state and out-of-state. So of those 6,500, a full 60% come from out-of-state. So that means that Oregon is only preparing and has for the last 3 years only been preparing about 40% of our new teacher workforce. And I tell you that because I don't think it's a well-kept secret that Oregon's licensure laws tend to favor the Oregon-prepared candidate. So when you look at the data of who's coming in, however, you know, it begs maybe having to look at some different ways that we do business. So I am a new teacher. Now I'm going to switch from being an out-of-state teacher to switch to being an in-state teacher. Let's say I just graduated from any teacher preparation and program in Oregon, and I've met all my requirements because the college has told us that they passed the test. They have to take, in Oregon, I have to pass my test before I get out of college to be considered to have completed my programs now. So for this first stage license. Now, the way the new license... Yeah.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Do you have any data on the passage rate for people taking the test before they graduate?
Representative Hobson, I have all kinds of data on that. we have 33 endorsement tests, and we have the MSAT test, and we have the administrator test, and then we have the other specialty tests. So,
is it high?
It's like about this thick. So it's actually fascinating. So it just depends. It is fascinating actually. What do you want to know that I might know?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do a high proportion, 80 or above percent of our teachers pass it?
Well, okay. It depends on the test. it was when I had to go through the statistics about 2 or 3 weeks ago, it appeared to me that most subject matter tests have a greater than 80% passage rate. I'll tell you what I should have brought and what I'd be happy to get to you is I have the passage rate for people who've declared to be Oregon candidates, whether they're in-state or out-of-state, on all the tests. And our lowest today is a passage rate of 54% on the PE content test. Our highest is 98.5% passage rate on the administrator test.
Mm.
Right. No, I'm sorry. No. I think
that's a show that you haven't got a demonstration up here. No.
I think it actually brings up issues we're talking about in our budget committee, and that's the need to look at our cut scores on our tests. 54% is obviously too small. There's a theory that people believe that the PE test will be easy to pass, so people who haven't been PE prepared take it, and therefore it skews the scores down. I have no evidence to back that up. So does that help? I'll bring the passage rate. That'll help.
Vicki, these charts regarding licenses, these also assume student teaching has been taken and successfully completed?
Yes. Back on the initial license and even the transitional license, when we say, in actually they're number twos in on both the scales, when we say completion of an approved teacher education program, completion in Oregon means you have student taught, you have done your practicum, you've met the standards on these pages, you've passed your basic skills test, and you've also passed your content test. So that's what that means. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the drafters of the new license thought that actually there are many features to the new license that are parallel the old license in some regards, and that may be some of the problem we're struggling with in design. But the thinking now and the way the statute reads is I come out, I get my brand new initial license, and then I'm given 6 years to complete the requirements for my continuing license. And that's not 6 years from the beginning. I get a 3-year initial license, and then I have a right to renew it once. And that once is what's carved into the statute and one of the reasons that I'm here. And that by the end of that 6 years, if I do not complete all the requirements on the lavender piece of paper here, I lose my license under the new design. There are no options that the commission has statutorily to give a teacher to continue to teach. That's another reason that we're here. So, yes.
Representative Hobson?
Thank you. Just to make sure that I'm understanding, so if I have that 6 years, even if I only teach 2 years of that 6 years, I still am limited to 6 years?
Okay. Let me do this differently. Chair Backlund and Representative Hobson, will you ask me that again slightly differently, because I don't think I understood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I was a teacher long enough to know that answer. It's like, good night, what in the world does she mean? If I get my, what's the first one, the initial, and in 3 years I get the transitional for 3 years, then I get the initial for 3 years. And at the end of that 6 years, I have to get the continuing.
No.
Oh,
thank
I'm sorry.
You. That's really helpful. Now, once I get my initial license, I have 6 years. Okay. If I am on a transitional license, I have 9 years.
Gotcha.
Okay. So the transitional is the out-of-state kind of transition into the new license. I'm sure that's the genesis of the name.
Follow up. That really helped me a lot, Vicki. And second to that, though, in that 9-year period that I have to renew, is that carved in stone so that if I only teach 2 years within that 9-year period, I'm still out?
Yes and no, and I'll try to explain that. Now, keep in mind, theoretically, Oregon graduates would never get a transitional license. Okay? Theoretically, all Oregon graduates would come out with their programs complete, and they get the initial license. So 40% of our new licensees are locked into the 6 years. Just keep that in mind. That TSPC has made an exception, and what they've said, and we have people who do continue to not pass the test, and they have been given transitional licenses. and just to because they are considered to not be program completers until they pass the test. So what the transitional license says is you haven't met all of our licensure requirements, and we're going to give you 3 years to do it. So we do have a few Oregon graduates who get transitional license, but it's very few. So, but what I have to do is, after I get my initial license, within the 6 years, I have to complete all the continuing license requirements. And another problem with the statute that we'll get to here when I talk about the bill is that the statute says I also have to have taught a minimum amount of time on my initial license. And if you'll go back a few minutes ago, I told you only 2,900 of our 6,500 licensed teachers are working. Part of that is job opportunity. Part of that stop out for real life children, all kinds of things that people might do. So I don't think the drafters of this original legislation contemplated people not just coming out of school, getting a license, and working and moving on. So I hope I'm helping here a little bit with the issues that we have. It might be, I'm going to really attempt to do this before I get into detail on the continuing license, a good idea to go to the bill now, because it might help us segue with some of the issues. What I did here, and I actually did this to help explain to other folks, I put the letters on the bill and I gave them the same information that I gave Mr. Keller earlier, is kind of an explanation of why we've asked for these certain changes. What all the bill has is the statute that contains the definition of the initial license and the statute that contains the definition of the continuing license. So in Section 1, which is the sole statutory definition for the initial license, it says that in number 2 on line 10 that it'll be issued for 3 years to an otherwise qualified candidate, and if you skip down to 14, it may be renewed once. See, that's where we got the 6 years. So because of the clearly evident part, we have, since this is 2003 and this program started in January 1, 1999, we're starting our first round of renewals. Our first round of 3 years is running out for those initially licensed candidates. So for the folks who aren't working, I need to have the capability to draft a rule that allow them to teach when they come back or continue, or, you know, something that's fair. So the other issue on the 3 years for the initial license, our old basic license was 3 years. I'm not sure why it was 3 years, and permanently it's 3 years, where our standard license was 5 years, and I'm sure that's part of the continuation of the design. In Washington, my new license is good for 5 years, and then it's good for another 5 years. If we're not locked into 3 years, we can have a much richer discussion about reciprocity with Washington on our first stage and second stage licenses. So it's an issue that we can look at, and that's why I thought it would be wise maybe to take that restriction out of there. So now I hope you have a picture of the first stage license. Now, I'm not going to look at the lavender for a minute and try to conceptualize this for you. In the old licensure system, I could go to school and continue to acquire content. So the thinking was, if I had a bachelor's in PE, and then I went in and I got a master's in PE, and I maybe even could have gotten a doctorate in PE, the more education I personally required, it was assumed I would then be a better teacher. I mean, that was pretty much the thinking. Well, and I think that's a little piece of it that we're having trouble having people convert over the thinking. Now the thinking is, if you have a master's in your subject matter area and you have your education preparation, if you have a bachelor's in your subject matter area and your education classes, that you should have to have a master's because it's similar to what we used to have for the standard license, because that gives you that much more subject matter. But then after that, we want to look back this way and say that, okay, after I've acquired my master's degree, I should have enough education to be a great teacher. Now what we want to know is, can I teach? No one ever asked that question under my old license. Could I teach? Other than the school district, which they have a right to ask. So now instead of it being about a teacher going out and acquiring more subject matter, it's about, can I teach PE? Have I got, I've received enough education, I've received my teaching classes. Now our second stage license is about proving I can teach PE, or French, or math, or science, or social studies, or health, or whatever it is my major was. That is the underlying concept of the continuing license. That if students have to get to outcomes where they can show what they performed, then it wasn't unreasonable in people's mind that teachers then would have to get to outcomes to show that they could perform. And so the design of the license is complex, to say the least. Let me start with the statute, because that was really the birth of the license, and then show you how it's been described in administrative rule. If we start on line 21 of your bill, it says a continuing license shall be issued on application for 5 years to an otherwise qualified applicant or person who has, on line 23, completed an advanced professional education program approved by the commission. Well, as you can see, that does not say complete a master's degree. All right? It doesn't say that. But our administrative rule does. So I'm telling you that so that enriches our discussion in a few minutes. So, and then on line 24, we've been employed on an initial license for a minimum period of time to be determined by the commission. And then it goes on to say in a public school or a private school, those are issues. Now let's tackle this, been employed on the initial license. This is the exact factor that cuts against the out-of-state teacher. Because if I come into the state, let's say I'm really, really busy, and that's not unlikely, and it takes me the full 3 years or whatever on my transitional license to get to take the test, or maybe I don't pass it immediately. Maybe it takes me the 3 years to pass the test. I can't move from my transitional license, even though I've completed all the requirements of the initial license, to the continuing license as an out-of-state teacher, because the statute says I have to have taught on an initial license. That doesn't seem reasonable to me on the face of it. So by taking out the language on the initial license, we can use the experience from the employment on the transitional license and allow out-of-state teachers to move immediately upon completing the requirements to the continuing license phase and save them some time. There is no pay difference for the two licenses, just to have that out there, but that's what that issue is about. Also, and then down on line 29, we have the new language, another educational setting approved by the commission. This is important, and I'll explain to you why, is this statute is designed great if all you're talking about is teachers. So because theoretically, I can't get my continuing license unless I'm employed, because I have to show you I can teach. And if I don't have a classroom of students, I can't show you I can teach. That's the theory. The problem is that we have a problem here with administrators with this rule, because we have now an initial license and a continuing license for administrators. Why can't an administrator have gotten experience at a community college, at a university, at any other educational setting that might not necessarily be these two? And I'm very limited because of the statute. So that's the genesis of the bold language, is allow it to apply a little better to the other licenses. The final change of the language is on the second page in line 3. It says the holder of a continuing license may renew the continuing license for 5 years. That locks it in. That means we can't make it longer or shorter if we needed to, by verification of successful teaching experience and continuing professional development. The verification of successful teaching experience seemed to be fairly vague, and it seemed like a good opportunity to take care of that issue. So, and we've asked for an emergency clause, because if the legislature allows us to pass this, the sooner we can get at changing our rules and looking at our rules, the better. Now I'll tell you about the continuing license. The part I didn't talk, which is probably the absolute heartbeat of the license, is on line 30. of the bill, and it says that the candidate who has a continuing license has to demonstrate minimum competencies, knowledge, and skills required for the license through an approved teacher education institution, school district, professional organization, or professional assessment approved by the commission. Okay, that is the linchpin. Those are what have now become known as the advanced competencies. So that's the statutory language that's translated into that 10 minutes it took me to explain to you. We want you to be able to show you can perform, frankly. So on the lavender sheet in the first bubble, to get my continuing teaching license, I have to demonstrate advanced competencies. The advanced competencies are on the back for you. And basically what it says is I can look at my entire classroom of students, I can make an individual learning plan for each one of those students, and I can show through proof that I can take each one of my students through learning gains. And that to have these successfully documented, I can do it through a program that's offered through a teacher institution, a school district, or a professional organization. The only requirement would be they'd have to come and have their program approved in front of the commission. And so this is the performance piece of the license. We're not getting much resistance to all of these. There's some pieces, and measuring them, as you know, can become a whole other issue. The completion of an advanced education program, that first line I showed you in A, has been translated to be a master's degree. Now, another place of the rule says or equivalent, and the commission has not done anything to define or equivalent. But we will have a policy degree discussion about the master's degree, because 70% of our newly licensed people do not have master's degrees. I don't think the commission was aware of that statistic when the rule was adopted.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki, when you said that we will have a policy discussion on the master's degree, is that the GSBC board?
Yes, the commission. When I say we, it's the royal we, because I don't have a vote. It's the commission. So, yes, that's what I meant. The other thing I think...
Oh, excuse me, Representative Nolan.
Excuse me, forgive my ignorance, but am I correct in understanding what you're saying now for anyone who has been licensed under these new rules? They're required to obtain a master's degree within 6 years of starting to teach.
Exactly. If they have not already. Mm-hmm. 30% of... I'm going to do this slowly, not because that's not implying a thing, so I can stay straight. The 75% of Oregon graduates come out with a master's degree already because of the college redesign that was done in the 80s. 25% of our Oregon graduates come out with bachelor's degrees. But 40% of our new license come from Oregon. So... 25% of 40% is 10% of 100%. So that's where I get to 70%. That 10% of 40%. That's right. Don't lose track here. That means 70% of our graduates do not have master's degree. Excuse me. 30% of our newly licensed people, which is our 60% of out-of-state folks and our 10% of Oregon graduates. So the issue with a master's degree, I think, is really clear in terms of resources and access, particularly east of the mountains, and some other issues that we have. So I think it was well-intentioned. I'm not sure that the long-term implications of it were really well-evaluated, I guess is what I'm trying to tell you.
Follow-up?
Vicki, do you know what percent of our continuing or seasoned teaching staff holds master's degrees?
I do not, but that's a really great question, and I'll look that up for you, too, because I was wondering that as I was preparing for this hearing myself. Many people who had elementary degrees and licenses were not required to get master's degrees, but did. All the secondaries did, and so I'm not sure we have that data specifically. We will after we have to gear up for No Child Left Behind, but it may not be accessible in terms of a data research on my repository right now. But I'll see.
And maybe one of our other witnesses has that information.
Vicki, then I lost my train of thought here a little bit, but I wanted to get back to the required master's degree issue. Does this bill address that?
No, it does not. It's an issue that can be exclusively addressed without the bill. It's an issue that can be handled by the commission by administrative rule, and it will be because I will make sure they have the policy discussion. I think it's a real issue, and it's part of one of the issues around the licenses we've been implementing. Because what the legislature said at the commission's request in 97 was that they just will have completed an advanced professional education program. It became translated sometime between 1997 and 1999 into a master's degree.
So did I hear you say then that if this committee were interested or was interested in doing away with its so-called master's degree requirement, we wouldn't have to have a bill? This could be taken care of, will be taken care of perhaps through administrative rule.
It's possible. Don't forget, I don't have a vote. I can promise you the commission will have a policy discussion about it, and I can also promise you the commission will be informed about the interest about the issue, and the commission will be as fully informed as you are with regard to data and the impact, the resource impact, and the percentage of teachers. So it would be very surprising to me if the commission did not look very hard at what that really means with regard to the license.
Do you have a timeline on that, perhaps?
Well, it's a little bit of a delicate issue. You don't like to get out ahead of the legislature on your policy discussions, and so it was my hope, if we got this bill through, that we could start the serious policy discussions in May, and the absolute latest, if we got this bill through, in August. If we don't get this bill through, I have some serious problems with people on licenses right now that I don't have any recourse other than to say, sorry, you can't teach until you meet the requirements. And I'm not sure that was ever, that may have been somebody's initial intent. I'm not sure it's fair, a fair outcome. So,
Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Follow up on that. Even though the master's degree isn't addressed in this bill, it could be. Right?
Oh, yes, ma'am. It could be. You could say there shall be no master's degree requirement.
Right. Follow up. And I would suggest that we certainly don't want to be ahead. I don't want to micromanage GSPC. But I'm assuming that you would carry the message back there, at least as interest here. I know from three people here there is, as Representative Dalto, and I've been writing notes back and forth.
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, yes, I will clearly take the message back to the commission. Whether this bill is passed or not, that is an issue that has to be discussed. I mean, it's a reality, and I want the agents from the commission to not be an ivory tower. I mean, we have to look at what's going on with districts and other things like that and take a really hard look and find out if decisions are research-backed and what is the evidence that says that a master's degree is the answer and that type of reasonable, reasoned decision-making. So, does that really sound like I'm blowing smoke? Because good, because I'm really not. I just don't have a firm answer about what direction this commission would go. So I'm just trying to be accurate.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, Representative Nolan?
If I might switch slightly in the line of questioning. I wanted to understand the change you're proposing in line 24 of page 1. And I heard you explain the issue with teachers coming with credentials from out of state being locked out
by the language that's currently in the bill, because they're not eligible, they're not initially eligible for an initial license. Could you accomplish the same objective that you're pursuing by staying been employed on an initial license or a transitional license? And
yes,
how would that
yeah.
differ? Would that have a different effect than just eliminating this language?
Chair Backlund and Representative Nolan, yes, legally I think it'd have a very different effect, because basically what it says, then you're limited to the two licenses, and it doesn't allow me to make an evaluation about teaching experience, perhaps out of state on another license. Mm-hmm. See, so for example, if I have taught for 10 years in Arizona, but I've never taken a teacher test, I could use that experience as a step toward it. And so it would fix the problem we've created by our licensure design, but it may also create a new problem in terms of being able to allow new people into the state to move as quickly into where they want to be with their licenses as they have a right to do. So, in other words, here, if you say, okay, let's do it this way. Let's say I come into the state and I have passed a basic skills test and I have passed a praxis test. Because if we add the language you want, I will still have had to have been employed on an initial or transitional license before I could get my continuing license. And otherwise, if we didn't say that, if I came into the state and I passed our requisite tests and I'd been prepared, theoretically I could go straight in and I've taught, which is the real crux here, I've acquired some experience. I could go into a continuing license program and prove to you I can lead my students to leading games and get my continuing license in the time in a expedited timeline that I can't do today because of how we wrote the statute. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. If I might have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. But it seems to me that you would already have that capacity because the statute allows the commission to set a minimum time period for demonstrating that. For being employed, and far from an expert in pedagogy, but Oregon's standards are different than other states. There would seem to me to be a value in having people teach on an initial or transitional license.
Well, let me
even
get
a year. Yeah. Before they're eligible for a continuing license.
Another scenario that I could see that could possibly be a problem is Washington's new licensure system is virtually identical to our new licensure system. And if we don't have too much restricting language in our statute, we may get to true reciprocity in terms of having if someone had taught in Washington. And if I had this restriction, then I'd have my problem, I'd have to say, well, I'm sorry, you still have to teach on this Oregon first stage license, even though you've completed all the requirements for an advanced license in Washington, which is very comparable to ours. You see what I'm saying? That's the problem with narrowing that like that. This is not unique to Oregon that we want people to prove they can teach, and so one of our problems with out-of-state people with experience is that they go through these same things in Washington. If we kept language in there like that, I'd have to make them go back on a beginning license.
And one more follow-up.
Yes, please.
And the issue I'm seeing, and perhaps it's a ghost that I don't need to worry about, you can help me. If you remove any reference to an initial license, it seems to me the new language that you're proposing would allow someone to go straight to a five-year license, not coming from out of state, but, say, coming from an uncertified teaching position.
They could not have done that, Representative Nolan, because in line 23, they have to have completed a professional education program.
Right. That doesn't mean they have to be certified. They don't have to be licensed.
No, if the statute says they've been employed for a minimum period of time, there aren't very many states that will allow you to teach without a license.
Been employed in a private school. I mean, there are plenty of private schools that don't require licensing of their teachers. So you could have someone who's been through an educational program, never been licensed, taught in a private school, and then eligible for a 5-year license at the state, never having demonstrated the initial competency.
Mr. Chair, may I add to that?
Yes, Representative.
Are there administrative rules that help further define some of these terms that we don't have in front of us
maybe
now?
Maybe that would help.
Such as where in subsection B you're talking about a minimum period of time to be determined by the commission, and then also in the sub big B there,
right,
standards adopted by the commission by rule. I'm wondering if there are rules that further define that you're basing some of your answers on that we don't know about.
I did not bring you the administrative rules for the initial license or the continuing license. They may or may not enlighten this discussion, truthfully. But I'm happy to give them to you because they may help. I think the point I want to get back to is that it's not about teaching on the license. I mean, it's about if I have gone through a teacher education program, if I pass the competency test, if I pass the basic skills test, if I've met all the other requirements, if I've taught for 5 years in a private school and I've never had a teaching license, if I can go through a program and prove somehow my qualifications to for the advanced competencies, there wouldn't be any reason I shouldn't be eligible for the second stage license. If that makes any sense at all. I don't think that there's... I think if we're performance-based, it's what I can do. It's not whether I've acquired a license and done it. So I'm not saying that it's inviting unlicensed people in, because we're pretty pleased if they've already been through a teacher preparation program and they've shown us the competencies for passing the test. That means they've had education in pedagogy and that they've demonstrated competency in pedagogy and subject matter. And then if we have the education has to be verified by the institution that hired them. The teaching experience has to be verified by the institution that hired them. So I feel desperately that I'm missing a point you're trying to make.
Well, my point is only that if licensing makes sense and we have confidence in our initial licensing steps, I'm not sure why we would want to create avenues for people to skip it.
If you've taught for 10 years in another state, you're not always happy to have to come in and go through the beginning of everything you've already gone through before, and I think that's the only real compelling argument I have.
Okay, and I granted you that one. I'm talking about an example where you haven't ever been licensed by anybody. So we can continue this conversation offline, but I'd need a little more information.
Vicki, may I suggest this? I see we're kind of pressing up against the timeline. Are others who want to testify, I think, are available. Would you be perhaps available next Wednesday to continue this discussion?
I believe so, Representative Backlund. I believe I am available.
We're considering our schedule, and it would be good for us if we could continue, and perhaps Wednesday's a good day for us. It could be some other day.
And would you be able to hear the people who are here today, since
yes,
I asked them to
yes
come? Thank you. My apologies.
I'm sorry about that. Those of you who had signed up to testify, I feel badly about that. Well, very good. With that, then, we'll adjourn the meeting.